Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today we're talking fecal transfer, and we're talking innovative approaches to gastrointestinal ailments with an expert. He's Dr. Mark Davis. He's at the IBD Specialty Center in Maryland, where he treats adults and children with IBD and complex GI cases. Wow, that's there's certainly a call for that. What type of patients do you see besides patients with ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease?
Well, I would say the type of referral I get the most from local practitioners are cases without a clear diagnosis, where people are suffering and have issues with digestion, food sensitivity, sometimes abdominal pain, changes in stool, and no one can figure out why. Sometimes they've been diagnosed with IBS, but as you know, that's sort of a what we call a wastebasket diagnosis, where we can't figure anything else out, but that fits these symptoms, we'll call it that. So I treat a fair amount of that. I work with people with celiac disease. And then there are patients with inflammatory bowel disease oftentimes have other autoimmune conditions. So that can lead to
exploring the role of the gut as a mediator in lupus or rheumatoid arthritis or any of a host of autoimmune conditions where the gut may play a role of primacy.
Liver disease, kidney disease, skin disease, sometimes even neurodegenerative disease can be helped with a focus on the gut.
Well, that's really exciting work. So apropos of neurodegenerative disease, I think one of the most exciting studies that's crossed my desk recently was a study looking at fecal transfer for children with autism. Can you speak to that?
Yes. Very interesting trial where they actually used a bacterial separation and concentration technique that separated the bacteria so completely from the stool that they were able to put it into chocolate milk or chocolate soy milk or almond milk or something and have these kids drink it. Wow. So that was the approach by which they delivered it to these kids, because having any kid sit still for an enema can be challenging. I've worked with kids of all ages with enemas, and it can be hard, especially repeatedly. And they had these kids.
Take chocolate milk over an enema any day.
So these were all kids with autism spectrum disorders and GI symptoms, which are common in autism. And what they found was, now they did not have a placebo group. So they were looking for significant changes from start to finish, not significance compared to a placebo group. But they did find statistically significant changes both in GI complaints and in clinician-observed and parent and caretaker-observed validated scales of social functioning and hyperactivity and other social and neurotypicality markers.
That's very promising. Any more work to be done along these lines? It probably has kindled a lot more interest in this as a intervention.
Yeah, there are no other trials I know of currently enrolling for that, but boy, that is a groundbreaking study, and I think there's a lot more work to be done in that area.
Okay. And, you know, we know that there clearly is a relationship between the microbiome and mood. Is there any plausibility to the notion that in future we'll develop poop pills or maybe modified poop pills for conditions like depression, anxiety, OCD, et cetera?
Yeah, I can say that I've seen depression as a comorbidity for some of my patients with IBS and IBD, and their depression will flare up when their gut symptoms flare up. And I've certainly seen that improve as their intestinal situation improves. So that may be a long way in the future, but I think that is a potential area of exploration as well.
So where along the line do you stratify fecal transfer in your patients with inflammatory bowel disease, ulcerative colitis, and Crohn's? Because I've been treating these patients for a long time, and we managed to get a high percentage of patients well with dietary interventions, with probiotics, with things like low-dose naltrexone, with herbal interventions. So I think you're not just running a chop shop for fecal transfer down there at the IBD Specialty Center. I think you probably start off with more conservative interventions that are often successful. What are some of your approaches?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I don't start with fecal transplant because my sources of knowledge are traditional medicines and the scientific literature and my own clinical experience. Mm-hmm. And in traditional medicines, fecal transplant was first used in the 4th century by a Chinese author named Ge Heng. Yeah. And it was published about in his Handbook for Emergency Therapies. And so he recommended other things for people with chronic diarrhea and bloody stools. He recommended diet. He recommended herbs. He recommended acupuncture. And only if those things failed did he move on to fecal transplant. Mm-hmm. Same thing in the modern literature. First modern report in 1958, Denver, Colorado. Those patients, they tried other conventional interventions first before they tried fecal transplant. So I try and follow those traditions. I work with diet. There's a few different diet blueprints I start with, including the specific carbohydrate diet.
Right, right. And, which are another one. Much in favor of. We've talked about this extensively here.
Yeah. And there's a very, very different diet that's a better blueprint for some people due to their own personal dietary choices called the semi-vegetarian diet. Mm-hmm. Brown rice every day, miso soup every day, fish once a week, meat once a month, lots of vegetables, no processed junk. Very different than specific carbohydrate diet, but a good blueprint for some other people. I also sometimes work with a low to no sulfur diet. Some people have bacteria like desulfovibrio that are able to reduce
just
dietary sulfur.
Thrives on sulfur, and you
that's
you
right.
deprive it of sulfur, and you get a benefit.
Yep, and they reduces it to hydrogen sulfide, which is corrosive to the gut. So I've found that to be a helpful diet for some people. So we work with diet. We work with nutrient therapies. Like I use liquid vitamin E oil as a rectal enema a lot. I use oral vitamin D. I use oral butyrate and other nutrient therapies. I use herbal therapies, like you mentioned. Curcumin and turmeric is one. Artemisia absinthium, wormwood is another one that I use a lot. Sometimes I'm using neem or other interventions. There's some Chinese formulas that I like. And then fecal transplant is something I use also, of course, if it's indicated for those people. And helminthic therapy is another therapy that I found to be very helpful sometimes.
Yeah, let's get into that because, you know, that I think is another kind of esoteric therapy that has great potential along the lines of fecal transfer. We're talking about feeding people worms, live worms.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm the poop and worm doctor. so yeah, these worms, some people call our old friends. When you look at fossilized human stool samples from 10, 20, 30, 40,000 years ago, they all have evidence of helminths in them. So it seems like as our human immune system was adapting over the past millennia, it was always adapting and learning to do its immune system dance with helminths as a dancing partner.
Yeah, that may be the purpose of IgE, immunoglobulin E,
right.
Helping us fend off parasite infections. And a high percentage of the world's population carries them, and they're okay with it. They actually may have more robust defenses against autoimmunity.
Yeah, in areas where helminths are very prevalent, autoimmune disease and other hyperinflammatory diseases like allergies and multiple sclerosis are pretty much absent. And we can see that certain when you now I don't want to say all helminths are good guys. There are some bad guys in the group. Elephantiasis is caused by helminths. River blindness is caused by helminths. So there are bad guys in the group. So when non-governmental organizations go into areas with endemic helminths and they deworm everybody, they give everybody anti-helminthics, it's actually good. It actually really improves quality of life in those areas. But we do see inflammatory markers go up and incidence of autoimmune diseases go up in those areas.
So it's a little bit of a trade-off.
It's a trade-off. And so I think the sweet spot in the middle where you get the best of both worlds is introducing small, carefully controlled amounts of the safest helminths. And so that's what I've done with the patients I've worked with. There are basically four helminths that are used therapeutically around the world. two are have animal hosts and two have human hosts. Mm-hmm. Trichura suey is a pig wickworm,
right? Mm-hmm.
Which there have been a bunch of trials of that in Crohn's disease, which have had mixed results. Some trials have had very good and significant results. Some have not had significance. Then there's Hymenolepis diminuta. That goes back and forth in its life cycle between beetles and rodents. And that's, I call it my gateway helmet because it's the least studied, but it's very safe and it's the easiest to obtain. It's very affordable. And it only lives in the human gut about 2 weeks. So you don't like it, you just stop taking it. Otherwise, you take it every couple weeks. And then there's Nicator americanus, the human hookworm. And there's Trichuris trichiura, the human whipworm, which I've used pretty extensively, those two, in my practice as well.
So how are these available? Because I know that Ovamed, which is the pig whipworm, was actually developed in the United States, but it's not necessarily approved in the United States.
It is not, right. Interestingly enough, people can obtain Trichuris suey, the Ovamed, the pig whipworm, themselves just by ordering it. So it started, actually, I think it was an American-German alliance. So the company is German, Ovamed, mm-hmm. owned in Germany. Yeah. But the actual worms are inoculated and isolated in a company in Thailand called Tanawisa, Tanawisa. And Americans, if I want my patient to go on TSO, I just have them go to tanawisa.com and they can order them themselves.
Okay. Yeah. So what type of results do we see with the use of these agents, and what are they designated for? Patients with inflammatory bowel disease? I do recall I had a patient of mine go to Europe and she obtained treatment for ulcerative colitis. And oh, by the way, she had MS. And she saw improvements in both, which is predictable according to this model.
That's right. In fact, I see mostly patients with inflammatory bowel disease. But the two most exciting places where helmets can be used, in my opinion, are not inflammatory bowel disease. Number one is celiac disease. Mm-hmm. Helminthic therapy is, to my knowledge, the only thing humans have ever studied that is able to allow people with celiac disease to tolerate gluten without getting any inflammation. Hmm. There was a great Australian trial, Croce et al., where the investigators gave about 20 of these Nicator americanus larvae to 11 people with celiac disease. 8 people finished the study. 1 flared early on and the other 2 moved. But of the 8 people who finished the study, all of them were able to, well, they were eating a bowl of spaghetti every day. And they studied them up and down. They looked at their blood. No inflammatory markers increased. They did capsule endoscopy. They showed no signs of changes in height between crypt depth and villus height, which is kind of the gold standard for looking at celiac disease. And they did celiac-specific quality of life surveys, and their quality of life just went up and up despite eating a bowl of spaghetti a day, which is impossible otherwise for celiac.
That's really impressive.
Yeah, I've used Nicator americanus with 3 patients with celiac. And 2 of them said, I'm happy to have this because I know I'm prone to hyperinflammation, but I still never want to eat gluten again. That's fine.
Right. Having been burned once, you don't want to go back there. Yeah. It's nice to not worry about the potential for someone to put a little gluten in a gravy or a sauce and not worry that you're going to have a major setback. But on the other hand, you may not want to tempt fate.
Exactly. The third was a young man with celiac disease and ankylosing spondylitis, an autoimmune condition that leads to painful inflammation of the back that can lead to the bones fusing, as you know. Mm-hmm. And he, anytime he was exposed to any gluten, would have very painful flares. So he said, you know what? I want to eat sandwiches and drink beer. Not all the time, but, you know, if I want to.
Have the option.
So he did. It's been 3 years since I worked with him, and he got Nicator americanus. And now if he feels like it, he has a beer, he'll eat a sandwich, he exposes himself to gluten knowingly. He has not had any flares of ankylosing spondylitis during that time, whereas he used to be debilitated several times per year. Wow. And he has not seen any increases in inflammatory markers. So that's a great case.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Well,
so where do you see this going? Because I think this all this stuff is in sort of a primitive stage right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the use of diet modification for ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. They've only just now undertaken a study at the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation. After so many years of our experiencing the benefits of this with our patients, they finally acceded to doing a study, mostly at the initiative of patients who had rich parents who said, hey, you know, I'm going to give you a couple $1 million and we're going to study this.
Yeah.
That's the condition of the grant. And so they are studying the use of diet now. But also things like poop pills, the use of helminths. These are not really that amenable to the U.S. Big pharma model, where we use powerful, patentable drugs that can be easily mm-hmm. characterized, and we're mm-hmm. less into biologics, you know, biologics, mm-hmm. There's kind of an uncertain patent status.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there are some companies working on making patentable microbiome products mm-hmm. or products derived from helminths. And it seems likely to me that we'll have an approved microbiome product, FDA-approved microbiome product, within the next 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Targeted, in other words.
Yeah, that will be as good at curing C. diff colitis as whole stool fecal transplant, but with none of the risk and just a dependable product. Mm-hmm. So I like that. Will that product be able to benefit people with inflammatory bowel disease or multiple sclerosis or other places where FMT can help? Or polymicrobial sepsis, for example, or metabolic syndrome, other places where FMT may help. Or chronic fatigue, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. That's another application, because obviously patients with CFS, fibromyalgia, there's a gut connection to those as well.
So will that targeted product benefit those, and will we be able to use them off-label for that? Only time will tell. My suspicion is we have a couple decades ahead of us, at least, of patients continuing to seek international treatment or doing DIY FMT mm-hmm. in order to obtain the results they're looking for or that they hope they will get.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So meanwhile, absent easily available prescription drugs or OTC probiotics, you act as sort of a clearinghouse for some of this information. So let's give you a shout out. Your practice, Mark Davis, is in Tacoma Park, Maryland, and your website is ibdspecialty.com.
Yes.
And is this a practice where it's essential for patients to head down to Maryland, or do you consult with people via internet or Skype or phone?
I do remote educational consultation. That's actually about half of my practice is mm-hmm. consulting with people via phone or Skype. But in those cases, it's just an educational consult. I'm not ordering any medicines or herbs or ordering any labs or anything. It's just a sharing of information. It's typically just one appointment, sometimes two, where I dump all the information I think is relevant in their labs, mm-hmm. And they can email me with any questions after that. But if people want me to order labs, actually help manage their care and be part of their team, mm-hmm. They have to come down and see me in Maryland. Or I go out to Oregon a couple times a year. I maintain a small practice there as well. So one of those places.
And you teach at the National College of Naturopathic Medicine out in Portland, correct?
And I'm actually on faculty at a naturopathic program that's starting here in Maryland called Maryland University of Integrative Health.
Oh, cool.
And they're an old school, actually. They've had an acupuncture program for about 30 years, and they have other integrative medicine programs. But they're just launching a naturopathic program, which I'm honored to be on the ground floor of.
Well, that's excellent, because we only have one other naturopathic school on the East Coast. It's up in Connecticut.
Yes.
So, naturopathy has been a West Coast, a left coast kind of thing until recently. Now it's making inroads on the East. It's very welcome.
Yeah.
And, you're certainly leading the charge in terms of expertise and out-of-the-box thinking in this field of gastroenterology, which is so important and so central, not just to GI problems, but to a multiplicity of systemic problems that people have. So congratulations.
And thank
I
you.
Will use you as a resource. I'm going to turn some patients on to you for some IBD specialty consultations to find out about some of these other options if they don't make progress with some of the simpler things we're doing.
Yeah, great.
Great stuff.
Yeah.
You want to give out your phone number, by the way, or do you prefer not to?
Okay, so that phone number is 301-364-9648.
Please repeat.
We're 301-364-9648, or people can email info@ibdspecialty.com.
Great. Well, I want to thank you very much. You've been very generous with your time, and congratulations on your pioneering work.
Thank you. Real pleasure talking with you, Ron.
My pleasure. Mark Davis, ND. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.